as well as in ordinary life. Some were very good people, people I valued greatly. But the ones I could consider to be genuine samurai, in every sense of the term, were very few. This man, Musashi, did you say? Appealed to me. I'd like to meet him, talk to him a little. Go bring him back.
Yes, sir, Yogoro answered obediently, but before getting to his feet, he continued in a slightly puzzled tone. What was it you noticed about him? You only saw him from a distance.
You wouldn't understand. When you do, you'll be old and withered like me.
But there must have been something.
I admired his alertness. He wasn't taking any chances, even on a sick old man like me. When he came through the gate, he paused and looked around, at the layout of the house, at the windows, whether they were open or closed, at the path to the garden, everything. He took it all in at a single glance. There was nothing unnatural about it. Anyone would have assumed he was simply halting for a moment as a sign of deference. I was amazed.
Then you believe he's a samurai of real merit?
Perhaps. I'm sure he'd be a fascinating man to talk to. Call him back.
Aren't you afraid it'll be bad for you? Kagenori had become quite excited, and Yogoro was reminded of the doctor's warning that his father shouldn't talk for any length of time.
Don't worry your head about my health. I've been waiting for years to meet a man like that. I didn't study military science all this time to teach it to children. I grant that my theories of military science are called the Oshu style, but they're not simply an extension of the formulas used by the famous Koshu warriors. My ideas differ from those of Takeda Shingen, or Uesugi Kenshin, or Oda Nobunaga, or the other generals who were fighting for control of the country. The purpose of military science has changed since then. My theory is directed toward the achievement of peace and stability. You know some of these things, but the question is, whom can I entrust my ideas to?
Yogoro was silent.
My son, while there are many things I want to pass on to you, you're still immature, too immature to recognize the remarkable qualities of the man you just met.
Yogoro dropped his eyes, but endured the criticism in silence.
If even I, inclined as I am to look favorably on everything you do, see you as immature, then there's no doubt in my mind. You're not yet the person who can carry on my work, so I must find the right man and entrust your future to him. I've been waiting for the right person to come along. Remember, when the cherry blossom falls, it must rely on the wind to spread its pollen.
You mustn't fall, father. You must try to live. The old man glared and raised his head.
Talk like that proves you're still a child. Now go quickly and find the samurai.
Yes, sir.
Don't push him. Just tell him roughly what I've told you, and bring him back with you.
Right away, father. Yogoro departed on the run. Once outside, he first tried the direction he'd seen Musashi take. Then he looked all over the shrine grounds, even went out to the main street running through Kojimachi, but to no avail. He was not unduly disturbed, for he was not as thoroughly convinced as his father of Musashi's superiority, nor was he grateful for Musashi's warning. The talk about Kojiro's unusual ability, about the folly of risking disaster over a trivial grievance, had struck in his craw. It was as though Musashi's visit had been for the express purpose of singing Kojiro's praises. Even while listening submissively to his father, he had been thinking to himself, "I'm not as young and immature as you say." And the truth was that just then, he really couldn't have cared less what Musashi thought. They were about the same age. Even if Musashi's talent was exceptional, there were limits to what he could know and what he could do. In the past, Yogoro had gone away for a year, 2 years, even three, to lead the life of the ascetic Shugyosha. He had lived and studied for a while at the school of another military expert, and he had studied Zen under a strict master. Yet his father, after merely catching a glimpse of the man, had not only formed what Yogoro suspected was an exaggerated opinion of the unknown Ronin's worth, but had gone so far as to suggest that Yogoro take Musashi as a model.
"May as well go back," he thought sadly. "I suppose there's no way to convince a parent that his son is no longer a child."
He longed desperately for the day when Kagenori would look at him and suddenly see that he was both a grown man and a brave samurai. It pained him to think that his father might die before that day arrived.
"Hey, Yogoro! It is Yogoro, isn't it?"
Yogoro turned on his heel and saw that the voice belonged to Nakatogawa Handayu, a samurai from the house of Hosokawa. They had not seen each other recently, but there had been a time when Handayu had attended Kagenori's lectures regularly.
"How's our revered teacher's health? Official duties keep me so busy I haven't had time to call."
"He's about the same, thanks."
"Say, I hear Hojo Shinzo attacked Sasaki Kojiro and was beaten."
"You've heard that already?"
"Yes, they were talking about it at Lord Hosokawa's this morning."
"It only happened last night."
"Kojiro is a guest of Iwama Kakube. Kakube must have passed the word around. Even Lord Tadanoshi knew about it."
Yogoro was too young to listen with detachment, yet he was loath to reveal his anger by some involuntary twitch. Taking leave of Handayu as quickly as possible, he hurried home. His mind was made up. The Talk of the Town. Kosuke's wife was in the kitchen making gruel for Shinzo when Iori came in.
"The plums are turning yellow," he said. "If they're almost ripe, that means the cicadas will be singing soon," she answered absently.
"Don't you pickle the plums?"
"No, there aren't many of us here, and pickling all those plums would take several pounds of salt."
"The salt wouldn't go to waste, but the plums will if you don't pickle them. And if there was a war or a flood, they'd come in handy, wouldn't they? Since you're busy taking care of the wounded man, I'll be happy to pickle them for you."
"My, what a funny child you are, worrying about floods and such. You think like an old man."
Iori was already getting an empty wooden bucket out of the closet. With this in hand, he sauntered out into the garden and looked up at the plum tree. Alas, though sufficiently grown up to worry about the future, he was still young enough to be easily distracted by the sight of a buzzing cicada. Sneaking closer, he captured it and held it in his cupped hands, making it screech like a terrified hag. Peeking between his thumbs, Iori experienced a strange sensation. Insects were supposed to be bloodless, he thought, but the cicada felt warm. Perhaps even cicadas, when faced with the peril of death, gave off body heat. Suddenly he was seized by a mixture of fear and pity. Spreading his palms, he tossed the cicada into the air and watched it fly off toward the street. The plum tree, which was quite large, was the home of a sizable community. Fat caterpillars with surprisingly beautiful fur, ladybirds, tiny blue frogs clinging to the undersides of leaves, small sleeping butterflies, dancing gadflies. Gazing in fascination at this little corner of the animal kingdom, He thought it would be inhuman to throw these ladies and gentlemen into consternation by shaking a branch. Carefully, he reached out, picked a plum, and bit into it. Then he shook the nearest branch gently and was surprised when the fruit did not fall off. Reaching out, he picked a few plums and dropped them into the bucket below.
"Son of a bitch!"
shouted Iori, abruptly firing three or four plums into the narrow lane next to the house. The clothes-drying pole between the house and the fence fell to the ground with a clatter, and footsteps hastily retreated from the lane into the street. Kosuke's face appeared at the bamboo grill of his workroom window.
"What was that noise?"
he asked, his eyes wide with astonishment. Jumping down from the tree, Iori cried, "Another strange man was hiding in the shadows, squatting right there in the lane. I threw some plums at him and he ran away." The sword polisher came outside, wiping his hands on a towel.
"What sort of man?"
"A thug.
One of Hangawara's men?"
"I don't know. Why do those men come snooping around here?"
"They're looking for a chance to get back at Shinzo."
Iori looked toward the back room, where the injured man was just finishing his gruel. His wound had healed to the extent that the bandage was no longer necessary.
"Kosuke!"
called Shinzo. The craftsman walked to the edge of the veranda and asked,
"How are you feeling?"
Pushing his tray aside, Shinzo reseated himself more formally.
"I want to apologize for causing you so much trouble."
"Don't mention it. I'm sorry I've been too busy to do more for you."
"I noticed that, besides worrying about me, you're being annoyed by those Hangawara hoodlums. The longer I stay, the more danger there is that they'll come to regard you as an enemy too. I think I should be leaving."
"Don't give it a thought.
I'm much better now, as you can see. I'm ready to go home."
"Today?"
"Yes."
"Don't be in such a hurry. At least wait until Musashi comes back."
"I'd rather not. But please thank him for me. He's been very kind to me, too. I can walk all right now."
"You don't seem to understand. Hangawara's men are watching this house day and night. They'll pounce on you the minute you step outside. I can't possibly let you leave alone."
"I had a good reason for killing Judo and Koroku. Kojiro started all this, not me. But if they want to attack me, let them attack."
Shinzo was on his feet and ready to go. Sensing there was no way of holding him back, Kosuke and his wife went to the front of the shop to see him off. Musashi appeared at the door just then, his sunburned forehead moist with sweat.
"Going out?"
he asked.
"Going home? Well, I'm glad to see you feel well enough, but it'd be dangerous to go alone. I'll go with you."
Shinzo tried to refuse, but Musashi insisted. Minutes later, they set off together.
"It must be difficult to walk after being in bed so long." "Somehow the ground seems higher than it really is."
"It's a long way to Hirakawa Tenjin. Why don't we hire a palanquin for you?"
"I suppose I ought to have mentioned it before. I'm not going back to the school."
"Oh, where then?"
Casting his eyes downward, Shinzo answered,
"It's rather humiliating, but I think I'll go to my father's house for a while. It's in Ushigome."
Musashi stopped the palanquin and virtually forced Shinzo into it. Despite the insistence of the bearers, Musashi refused one for himself, to the disappointment of the Hangawara men watching from around the next corner.
"Look, he put Shinzo into a palanquin.
I saw him glance this way.
It's too early to do anything yet."
After the palanquin turned right by the outer moat, they hitched up their skirts, pulled back their sleeves, and followed along behind, their glittering eyes seemingly ready to pop out and shoot toward Musashi's back. Musashi and Shinzo had reached the neighborhood of Ushigafuchi when a small rock glanced off the palanquin pole. At the same time, the gang started shouting and moved in to surround its prey.
"Wait!"
called one of them.
"Just stay where you are, you bastard!"
The bearers, terrified, dropped the palanquin and fled. Shinzo crawled out of the palanquin, hand on sword. Pulling himself to his feet, he assumed a stance and cried,
"Is it me you're telling me to wait?"
Musashi jumped in front of him and shouted, "State your business!" The hoodlums inched closer, cautiously, as though feeling their way through shallow water.
"You know what we want," spat one of them. "Turn over that yellow belly you're protecting, and don't try anything funny, or you'll be dead too."
Encouraged by this bravado, they seethed with bloodthirsty fury, but none advanced to strike with his sword. The fire in Musashi's eyes was sufficient to hold them at bay. They howled and cursed from a safe distance. Musashi and Shinzo glared at them in silence. Moments passed before Musashi took them unawares by shouting,
"If Hangawara Yajibe is among you, let him come forward." "The boss isn't here, but if you have anything to say, speak to me, Nembutsu Tazaemon, and I'll do you the favor of listening."
The elderly man who stepped forward wore a white hemp kimono and had Buddhist prayer beads hung around his neck.
"What do you have against Hojo Shinzo?"
Squaring his shoulders, Tazaemon replied,
"He slaughtered two of our men."
"According to Shinzo, you two louts helped Kojiro kill a number of Obata's students."
"That was one thing. This is another. If we don't settle our score with Shinzo, we'll be laughed off the streets."
"That may be the way things are done in the world you live in," Musashi said in a conciliatory tone, "but it's different in the world of the samurai. Among warriors, you can't fault a man for seeking and taking his proper revenge. A samurai may take revenge for the sake of justice or to defend his honor, but not to satisfy a personal grudge. It's not manly, and what you're trying to do right now isn't manly."
"Not manly? You're accusing us of being unmanly?"
"If Kojiro came forward and challenged us in his own name, that'll be all right. But we can't get involved in a squabble raised by Kojiro's minions."
"There you go, preaching self-righteously just like any other samurai. Say what you please, we still have to protect our name."
"If samurai and outlaws fight over whose rules are to prevail, the streets will be filled with blood. The only place to settle this is at the magistrate's office. How about it, Nembutsu?"
"Horse manure! If it was something the magistrate could settle, we wouldn't be here to begin with."
"Listen, how old are you?"
"What business is it of yours?"
"I'd say you look old enough to know you shouldn't be leading a group of young men to a meaningless death."
"Ah, keep your smart talk to yourself. I'm not too old for a fight."
Tazaemon drew his sword, and the hoodlums moved forward, jostling and shouting. Musashi dodged Tazaemon's thrust and grabbed him by the back of his gray head. Covering the 10 paces or so to the moat in great strides, he summarily dumped him over the edge. Then, as the mob closed in, he dashed back, picked Shinzo up by the waist, and made off with him. He ran across a field, toward the middle reaches of a hill. Below them, a stream flowed into the moat, and a bluish marsh was visible at the bottom of the slope. Halfway up, Musashi stopped and stood Shinzo on his feet.
"Now," he said, "let's run."
Shinzo hesitated, but Musashi prodded him into motion. The hoodlums, having recovered from their shock, were giving chase.
"Catch him! No pride! That's a samurai!
He can't throw Tazaemon in the moat and get away with it!" Ignoring the taunts and slurs, Musashi said to Shinzo,
"Don't even consider getting involved with them. Run! It's the only thing to do in a case like this."
With a grin, he added,
"It's not so easy to make good time on this terrain, is it?"
They were passing through what would someday be known as Ushigafuji and Kudang Hill, but now the area was heavily wooded. By the time they lost their pursuers, Shinzo's face was deathly pale.
"Worn out?" Musashi asked solicitously. It's not so bad.
I suppose you don't like the idea of letting them insult us like that without fighting back.
Well,
think about it quietly and calmly, and you'll see why. There's times when it makes you feel better to run away. There's a stream over there. Rinse your mouth out, and then I'll take you to your father's house. In a few minutes, the forest around the Akagi Myojin shrine came into view. Lord Hojo's house was just below.
I hope you'll come in and meet my father, Shinzo said when they came to the earthen wall surrounding the house.
Some other time. Get plenty of rest and take care of yourself. With that, he was off. After this incident, Musashi's name was heard quite frequently in the streets of Edo, far more frequently than he would have wished. People were calling him a fake, the coward to end all cowards, and saying, shameless, a disgrace to the samurai class. If a fraud like that defeated the Yoshiokas in Kyoto, they must have been hopelessly weak. He must have challenged them knowing they couldn't protect themselves. And then he probably ran away before he was in any real danger. All that phony wants to do is sell his name to people who don't know swordsmanship. Before long, it was impossible to find anyone who would put in a good word for him. The crowning insult was signs posted all over Edo. Here's a word to Miyamoto Musashi, who turned tail and ran. The Honiden Dowager is eager for revenge. We, too, would like to see your face instead of your back for a change. If you are a samurai, come out and fight. The Hangawara Association.
Book 6. Sun and Moon. A Chat with the Men. Before having breakfast, Lord Hosokawa Tadatoshi began his day with the study of the Confucian classics. Official duties, which often required his attendance at Edo Castle, consumed most of his time, but when he could fit it into his schedule, he practiced the martial arts. Evenings, whenever possible, he liked to spend in the company of the young samurai in his service. The atmosphere was rather like that of a harmonious family seated around its patriarch, not completely informal, to be sure, for the idea that his lordship was just one of the boys was not encouraged, but the usually rigorous etiquette was relaxed a bit. Tadatoshi, lounging in a lightweight hemp kimono, encouraged an exchange of views, which often included the latest gossip.
Okatani, said his lordship, singling out one of the more robust men.
Yes, sir.
I hear you're pretty good with the lance now.
That's right. Very good, in fact.
Ha ha! You certainly don't suffer from false modesty.
Well, sir, with everybody else saying so, why should I deny it?
One of these days, I'll find out for myself how advanced your technique really is.
I've been looking forward to that day, but it never seems to come.
You're lucky it doesn't.
Tell me, sir, have you heard the song everybody's singing?
What's that?
It goes like this. There's lancers and lancers, all sorts of lancers, but the greatest one of all is Okatani Goroji.
Tadatoshi laughed. You can't take me in that easily. That song's about Nagoya Sanzo.
The others joined in the laughter. Oh, you knew?
You'd be surprised at what I know.
He was on the verge of giving further evidence of this, but thought better of it. He enjoyed hearing what his men were thinking and talking about, and considered it his duty to keep himself well informed, but it would hardly do to reveal just how much he actually knew. Instead, he asked,
"How many of you are specializing in the lance? How many in the sword?"
Out of 7, 5 were studying the lance, only 2 the sword.
"Why do so many of you prefer the lance?" asked Tadatoshi.
The consensus among the lancers was that it was more effective in battle.
"And what do the swordsmen think about that?"
One of the 2 replied, "The sword is better.
Swordsmanship prepares you for peace as well as for war. This was a perennial subject for discussion, and the debate was usually lively. One of the lancers asserted, "The longer the lance is, the better, provided it's not too long to handle efficiently. The lance can be used for striking, thrusting, or slicing, and if you fail with it, you can always fall back on your sword. If you have only a sword and it gets broken, that's it."
"That may be true," rejoined an exponent of sword fighting. "But a samurai's work isn't limited to the battlefield. The sword is his soul. To practice its art is to refine and discipline your spirit. In the broadest sense, the sword is the basis for all military training, whatever drawbacks it may have in battle. If you master the inner meaning of the way of the samurai, the discipline can be applied to the use of the lance or even guns. If you know the sword, you don't make silly mistakes or get taken unawares. Swordsmanship is an art with universal applications." The argument might have gone on indefinitely had not Tadatoshi, who had been listening without taking sides, said, "Mainosuke, what you just said sounds to me like something you heard somebody else say." Matsushita Mainosuke grew defensive.
"No, sir, that's my own opinion."
"Come now, be honest."
"Well, to tell the truth, I heard something similar when I was visiting Kakube recently. Sasaki Kojiro said about the same thing, but it fitted in so well with my own idea, I wasn't trying to deceive anyone. Sasaki just put it into words better than I could."
"I thought as much," said Tadatoshi with a knowing smile. The mention of Kojiro's name reminded him that he had not yet made a decision as to whether to accept Kakube's recommendation. Kakube had suggested that since Kojiro was not very old, he might be offered 1,000 bushels or so. But much more than the matter of the stipend was involved. Tadatoshi had been told by his father many times that it was of prime importance to first exercise good judgment in hiring samurai and then to treat them well. Before accepting a candidate, it was imperative to assess not only his skills, but also his character. No matter how desirable a man might seem to be, if he could not work together with the retainers who had made the House of Hosokawa what it was today, he would be virtually useless. A fief, the elder Hosokawa had advised, was like a castle wall built of many rocks. A rock that could not be cut to fit in comfortably with the others would weaken the whole structure, even though the rock itself might be of admirable size and quality. The daimyo of the new age left the unsuitable rocks in the mountains and fields, for there was an abundance of them. The great challenge was to find one great rock that would make an outstanding contribution to one's own wall. Thought of in this way, Tadatoshi felt, Kojiro's youth was in his favor. He was still in his formative years and, consequently, susceptible to a certain amount of molding. Tadatoshi was also reminded of the other ronin. Nagaoka Sado had first mentioned Musashi at one of these evening get-togethers. Though Sado had allowed Musashi to slip through his fingers, Tadatoshi had not forgotten him. If Sado's information was accurate, Musashi was both a better fighter than Kojiro and a man of sufficient breadth to be valuable in government. As he compared the two, he had to admit that most daimyo would prefer Kojiro. He came from a good family and had studied the art of war thoroughly. Despite his youth, he had developed a formidable style of his own, and he had gained considerable fame as a fighter. The story of his brilliant defeat of men from the Obata Academy on the banks of the Sumida River and again at the dike on the Kanda River was already well known. Nothing had been heard of Musashi for some time. His victory at Ichijoji had made his reputation, but that had been years ago, and soon afterward word had spread that the story was exaggerated, that Musashi was a seeker after fame, who had trumped up the fight, made a flashy attack, and then fled to Mount Hiei. Every time Musashi did something praiseworthy, a spate of rumors followed, denigrating his character and ability. It had reached the point where even the mention of his name usually met with critical remarks, or else people ignored him entirely. As the son of a nameless warrior in the mountains of Mimasaka, his lineage was insignificant. Though other men of humble origin, most notably Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who came from Nakamura in Owari province, had risen to glory in recent memory, people were on the whole class-conscious and not given to paying much heed to a man of Musashi's background. As Tadatoshi mulled over the question, he looked around and asked, "Do any of you know of a samurai named Miyamoto Musashi?"
"Musashi?" replied a surprised voice. "It'd be impossible not to hear of him. His name's all over town."
It was evident that they were all familiar with the name.
"Why is that?"
A look of anticipation came over Tadatoshi's face.
"There are signs up about him,"
offered one young man, with a slight air of reticence. Another man, whose name was Mori, chimed in.
"People were copying the signs, so I did too. I've got it with me now. Shall I read it?"
"Please do."
"Ah, here it is," said Mori, unfolding a crumpled scrap of paper. "Here's a word to Miyamoto Musashi, who turned tail and ran."
Eyebrows were raised and smiles began to appear, but Tadatoshi's face was grave.
"Is that all?"
"No."
He read the rest of it and said,
"The signs were put up by a gang from the Carpenter's District. People find it amusing because it's a case of street ruffians tweaking the nose of a samurai."
Tadatoshi frowned slightly, feeling that the words maligning Musashi called his own judgment into question. This was a far cry from the image he had formed of Musashi. Still, he was not ready to accept what he had heard at face value. He murmured. "I wonder if Musashi is really that sort of man."
"I gather he's a worthless lout," volunteered Mori, whose opinion was shared by the others. "Or at least a coward. If he wasn't, why would he allow his name to be dragged through the mud?"
The clock struck, and the men departed, but Tadatoshi sat on, thinking, "There's something interesting about this man." Not one to be swayed by the prevailing opinion, he was curious to know Musashi's side of the story. The next morning, after listening to a lecture on the Chinese classics, he emerged from his study into the veranda and caught sight of Sado in the garden.
"Good morning, my elderly friend," he called.
Sado turned and politely bowed his morning greeting.
"Are you still on the lookout?" asked Tadatoshi.
Puzzled by the question, Sado merely stared back.
"I mean, are you still keeping an eye out for Miyamoto Musashi?" "Yes, my lord,"
Sado lowered his eyes.
"If you do find him, bring him here. I want to see what he's like."
Shortly after noon on the same day, Kakubei approached Tadatoshi at the archery range and pressed his recommendation of Kojiro. As he picked up his bow, the young lord said quietly,
"Sorry, I'd forgotten. Bring him any time you wish. I'd like to have a look at him. Whether he becomes a retainer or not is another matter, as you well know."
Buzzing Insects. Seated in a back room of the small house Kakube had lent him, Kojiro was examining the drying pole. After the incident with Hojo Shinzo, he had requested Kakube to press the craftsman for the return of the weapon. It had come back this morning.
"It won't be polished, of course," Kojiro had predicted, but in fact, the sword had been worked on with an attention and care that were beyond his wildest hopes.
From the blue-black metal, rippling like the current of a deep-running stream, there now sprang a brilliant white glow, the light of centuries past. The rust spots, which had seemed like leprous blemishes, were gone. The wavy tempering pattern between the blade's edge and the ridge line hitherto smudged with bloodstains, was now as serenely beautiful as a misty moon floating in the sky.
"It's like seeing it for the first time," marveled Kojiro.
Unable to take his eyes from the sword, he didn't hear the visitor calling from the front of the house.
"Are you here? Kojiro!"
This part of the hill had been given the name Tsukino Misaki because of the magnificent view it afforded of the rising moon. From his sitting room, Kojiro could see the stretch of bay from Shiba to Shinagawa. Across the bay, frothy clouds appeared to be on a level with his eyes. At this moment, the white of the distant hills and the greenish blue of the water seemed fused with the blade.
"Kojiro! Isn't anybody here?"
This time, the voice came from the grass-woven side gate. Coming out of his reverie, he shouted, "Who is it?" and returned the sword to its scabbard.
"I'm in the back. If you want to see me, come around to the veranda."
"Oh, here you are," said Osugi,
walking around to where she could see into the house.
"Well, this is a surprise," said Kojiro cordially. "What brings you out on a hot day like this?"
"Just a minute. Let me wash my feet. Then we can talk."
"The well's over there. Be careful. It's quite deep. You, boy, go with her and see she doesn't fall in."
The man addressed as Boy was a low-ranking member of Hangawara's gang who had been sent along to guide Osugi. After washing her sweaty face and rinsing her feet, Osugi entered the house and exchanged a few words of greeting. Noticing the pleasant breeze coming off the bay, she squinted and said,
"The house is nice and cool. Aren't you afraid you'll get lazy, staying in a comfortable place like this?"
Kojiro laughed.
"I'm not like Matahachi."
The old woman blinked her eyes sadly, but ignored the barb.
"Sorry, I didn't bring you a real gift," she said. "In place of one, I'll give you a sutra I copied."
As she handed him the Sutra on the Great Love of Parents, she added,
"Please read it when you have time."
After a perfunctory glance at her handiwork, Kojiro turned to her guide and said,
"That reminds me, did you put up the signs I wrote for you?
The ones telling Musashi to come out of hiding?"
"Yes, those.
It took us 2 whole days, but we put one up at almost every important intersection."
Osugi said,
"We passed some on the way here. Everywhere they're posted, people are standing around gossiping. It made me feel good to hear the things they're saying about Musashi."
"If he doesn't answer the challenge, he's finished as a samurai. The whole country will be laughing at him. That should be ample revenge for you, Granny."
"Not on your life. Being laughed at isn't going to get through to him. He's shameless. And it won't satisfy me, either. I want to see him punished once and for all."
"Aha!"
laughed Kojiro, amused by her tenacity.
"You get older, but you never give up, do you?
By the way, did you come about anything in particular?"
The old lady rearranged herself and explained that after more than 2 years with Hangawara, she felt she should be moving on. It was not right for her to live on Yajibe's hospitality indefinitely. Besides, she was tired of mothering a house full of roughnecks. She had seen a nice little place for rent in the vicinity of Yoroi Ferry.
"What do you think?"
Her face was serious, questioning.
"It doesn't look like I'll find Musashi soon, and I have a feeling Matahachi's somewhere in Edo. I think I should have some money sent from home and stay on for a while, but by myself, as I said."
There being no reason for Kojiro to object, he quickly agreed with her. His own connection with the Hangarawa menage, entertaining and useful at the beginning, was now a little embarrassing. It was certainly no asset to a ronin looking for a master. He had already decided to discontinue the practice sessions. Kojiro summoned one of Kakube's subordinates and had him bring a watermelon from the patch behind the house. They chatted while it was being cut and served, but before long he showed his guest out, his manner rather suggesting he preferred to have her out of the way before sundown. When they had left, He himself swept his rooms and sprinkled the garden with well water. The morning glory and yam vines growing on the fence had reached the top and returned to the ground again, threatening to ensnare the foot of the stone water basin. Their white flowers waved in the evening breeze. In his room again, he lay down and wondered idly if his host would be on duty that night at the Hosokawa house. The lamp, which would probably have been blown out by the wind anyway, was unlit. The light of the moon, rising beyond the bay, was already on his face. At the bottom of the hill, a young samurai was breaking through the cemetery fence. Kakube stabled the horse he rode to and from the Hosokawa mansion at a florist's shop at the foot of Isarago Hill. This evening, curiously enough, there was no sign of the florist, who always came out promptly to take charge of the animal. Not seeing him inside the shop, Kakube went around to the back and started to tether his horse to a tree. As he did so, the florist came running out from behind the temple. Taking the reins from Kakube's hands, he panted, "Sorry, sir. There was a strange man in the cemetery, on his way up the hill. I shouted, told him there was no pathway there. He turned and stared at me. Angry he was, then disappeared." He paused for a moment, peered up into the dark trees, and added worriedly, "Do you think he could be a burglar? They say a lot of daimyo houses have been broken into recently." Kakube had heard the rumors, but he replied with a short laugh, "That's all talk, nothing more. If the man you saw was a burglar, I dare say he was a petty thief, or one of the ronin who waylay people on the streets." "Well, we're right here at the entrance to the Tokaido, and lots of travelers have been attacked by men fleeing to other provinces. It makes me nervous when I see suspicious-looking men around at night."
"If anything happens, run up the hill and knock at my gate. The man staying with me is chafing at the bit, always complaining there's never any action around here."
"You mean Sasaki Kojiro? He's got quite a reputation as a swordsman here in the neighborhood."
Hearing this did Kakube's self-esteem no harm. Apart from liking young people, he knew quite well that it was regarded as both admirable and wise for established samurai like himself to take on promising younger men as proteges. Should an emergency arise, there could be no more persuasive proof of his loyalty than to be able to furnish his lord with good fighters. And if one of them turned out to be outstanding, due credit would be given to the retainer who had recommended him. One of Kakube's beliefs was that self-interest was an undesirable trait in a vassal. Nevertheless, he was realistic. In a large fief, there were few retainers willing to disregard their own interests entirely. Despite the fact that he held his position through heredity, Kakube was as loyal to Lord Tadatoshi as the other retainers, without being the sort who would strive to outdo others in demonstrating his fealty. For purposes of routine administration, men of his type were on the whole much more satisfactory than the firebrands who sought to perform spectacular feats.
"I'm back,"
he called on entering the gate to his house. The hill was quite steep, and he was always a little winded when he reached this point. Since he had left his wife in the country, and the house was populated mostly by men, with only a few woman servants, feminine touches tended to be lacking. Yet on evenings when he had no night duty, he invariably found the stone path from the red gate to the entrance inviting, for it had been freshly watered down in anticipation of his return. And no matter how late the hour, someone always came to the front door to greet him.
"Is Kojiro here?"
he asked.
"He's been in all day," replied the servant. "He's lying down in his room, enjoying the breeze."
"Good. Get some sake ready and ask him to come in to see me."
While preparations were being made, Kakube took off his sweaty clothes and relaxed in the bath. Then, donning a light kimono, he entered his sitting room, where Kojiro sat waving a fan. The sake was brought in. Kakube poured, saying,
"I called you because something encouraging happened today that I wanted to tell you about."
"Good news?"
Since I mentioned your name to Lord Tadatoshi, he seems to have heard of you from other sources as well. Today he told me to bring you to see him sometime soon. As you know, it's not easy to arrange these matters. There are dozens of retainers with someone they want to suggest.
His expectation that Kojiro would be immensely pleased showed clearly in his tone and manner. Kojiro put his cup to his lips and drank. When he did speak, his expression was unchanged and he said only, "Let me pour you one now." Kakube, far from being put out, admired the young man for being able to conceal his emotions.
"This means I've been successful in carrying out what you requested of me. I think that calls for a celebration. Have another."
Kojiro bowed his head slightly and mumbled, "I'm grateful for your kindness."
"I was only doing my duty, of course," Kakube replied modestly. "When a man is as capable and talented as you, I owe it to my lord to see that you're given consideration."
"Please don't overestimate me. And let me re-emphasize one point. It's not the stipend I'm interested in. I simply think the House of Hosokawa is a very good one for a samurai to serve. It's had 3 outstanding men in a row." The 3 men were Tadatoshi and his father and grandfather, Sansai and Yusai.
"You needn't think I've talked you up to the high heavens. I didn't have to. The name Sasaki Kojiro is known throughout the capital."
"How could I be famous when all I do is loaf around here all day long? I don't see that I'm outstanding in any way. It's just that there are so many fakes around."
"I was told that I could bring you any time. When would you like to go?"
"Any time suits me too."
"How about tomorrow?"
"That's all right with me." His face revealed no eagerness, no anxiety, only calm self-confidence. Kakube, even more impressed at his sangfroid, chose this time to say matter-of-factly,
"You understand, of course, his lordship won't be able to make a final decision until he's seen you. You needn't let that worry you. It's only a matter of form. I have no doubt but what the position will be offered."
Kojiro set his cup down on the table and stared straight into Kakube's face. Then, very coldly and defiantly, he said, "I've changed my mind. Sorry to have put you to so much trouble."
Blood seemed about to burst from his earlobes, already bright red from the drink. What?
Stammered Kakube.
"You mean you're giving up the chance for a position with the House of Hosokawa?"
"I don't like the idea," answered his guest curtly, offering no further explanation. His pride told him there was no reason for him to submit to an inspection. Dozens of other daimyo would snap him up sight unseen for 1,500, even 2,500 bushels. Kakube's puzzled disappointment seemed to make no impression on him whatsoever, nor did it matter that he would be regarded as a willful ingrate. Without the least suggestion of doubt or repentance, he finished off his food in silence and returned to his own quarters. The moonlight fell softly on the tatami. Stretching out drunkenly on the floor, arms under his head, he began to laugh quietly to himself. "Honest man, that Kakube. Good old honest Kakube." He knew his host would be at a loss to explain this sudden shift to Tadatoshi, but he knew also that Kakube would not be angry at him for very long, no matter how outrageously he behaved. While he had piously denied interest in the stipend, he was in fact consumed with ambition. He wanted a stipend and much more, every ounce of fame and success he could possibly achieve. Otherwise, what would be the purpose of persevering through years of arduous training? Kojiro's ambition was different from that of other men only by dint of its magnitude. He wanted to be known throughout the country as a great and successful man, to bring glory to his home in Iwakuni, to enjoy every one of the benefits that can possibly derive from being born human. The quickest road to fame and riches was to excel in the martial arts. He was fortunate in having a natural talent for the sword. He knew this, and derived no small measure of self-satisfaction from it. He had planned his course intelligently and with remarkable foresight. Every action of his was calculated to put him closer to his goal. To his way of thinking, Kakube, though his senior, was naive and a little sentimental. He fell asleep, dreaming of his brilliant future. Later, when the moonlight had edged a foot across the tatami, a voice no louder than the breeze whispering through the bamboo said, "Now!" A shadowy form, crouching among the mosquitoes, crept forward like a frog to the eaves of the unlighted house. The mysterious man seen earlier at the foot of the hill advanced slowly, silently, until he reached the veranda, where he stopped and peered into the room. Stooping in the shadows out of the moonlight, he might have remained undiscovered indefinitely had he himself made no sound. Kojiro snored on. The soft hum of insects, briefly interrupted as the man moved into position, came again across the dew-covered grass. Minutes passed. Then the silence was broken by the clatter the man made as he whipped out his sword and jumped up onto the veranda. He leapt toward Kojiro and cried, "Ark!" an instant before he clenched his teeth and struck. There was a sharp hissing as a long black object descended heavily on his wrist, but the original force of his strike had been powerful. Instead of falling from his hand, his sword sank into the tatami, where Kojiro's body had been. Like a fish darting away from a pole striking water, the intended victim had streaked to the wall. He now stood facing the intruder, the drawing pole in one hand, its scabbard in the other. "Who are you?" Kojiro's breathing was calm. Alert as always to the sounds of nature's creatures, to the falling of a dewdrop, he was unperturbed.
It's me."
"Me doesn't tell me anything. I know you're a coward, attacking a man in his sleep. What's your name?"
"I am Yogoro, the only son of Obata Kagenori. You took advantage of my father when he was sick, and you spread gossip about him all over the city."
"I wasn't the one who spread the gossip. It was the gossipers, the people of Edo."
"Who was it who lured his students into a fight and killed them?"
"I did that, no doubt about it. I, Sasaki Kojiro."
"How can I help it if I'm better than they? Stronger, braver, more knowledgeable in the art of war. How can you have the gall to say that when you called on Hangawara's vermin to help you?"
With a snarl of disgust, Kojiro took a step forward.
"If you want to hate me, go ahead. But any man who carries a personal grudge into a test of strength in the art of war isn't even a coward. He's worse than that, more pitiable, more laughable. So once again, I have to take the life of an Obata man. Are you resigned to that?"
No answer.
"I said, are you resigned to your fate?"
He moved another step forward. As he did so, the light of the moon reflecting off the newly polished blade of his sword blinded Yogoro. Kojiro stared at his prey as a starving man stares at a feast. The Eagle. Kakube regretted having allowed himself to be used shabbily and vowed to have nothing more to do with Kojiro. Yet deep down, he liked the man. What he didn't like was being caught between his master and his protege. Then he began to rethink the matter.
"Maybe Kojiro's reaction proves how exceptional he is. The ordinary samurai would have jumped at the chance to be interviewed."
The more he reflected on Kojiro's fit of pique, the more the ronin's independent spirit appealed to him. For the next 3 days, Kakube was on night duty. He did not see Kojiro until the morning of the fourth day, when he walked casually over to the young man's quarters. After a short but awkward silence, he said,
"I want to talk to you for a minute, Kojiro. Yesterday, when I was leaving, Lord Tadatoshi asked me about you. He said he'd see you. Why don't you drop in at the archery range and have a look at the Hosokawa technique?"
When Kojiro grinned without replying, Kakube added,
I don't know why you insist on thinking it's demeaning. It's usual to interview a man before offering him an official position.
I know, but supposing he rejects me, then what? I'd be a cast-off, wouldn't I? I'm not so hard up that I have to go around peddling myself to the highest bidder.
Then the fault is mine. I put it the wrong way. His lordship never meant to imply any such thing.
Well, what answer did you give him?
None yet. But he seems a little impatient.
Aha! You've been very thoughtful, very helpful. I suppose I shouldn't put you in such a difficult position.
Wouldn't you reconsider? Go and call on him just once?
All right, if it means so much to you,
Kojiro said patronizingly, but Kakube was nonetheless pleased.
How about today?
So soon?
Yes.
What time?
How about a little after noon? That's when he practices archery.
All right, I'll be there.
Kojiro set about making elaborate preparations for the meeting. The kimono he chose was of excellent quality, and the hakama was made of imported fabric. Over the kimono he wore a formal vest-like garment of sheer silk, sleeveless but with stiff flaring shoulders. To complement his finery, he had the servants provide him with new zori and a new basket hat.
"Is there a horse I can use?" he inquired. "Yes, the master's spare horse, the white one, is at the shop at the bottom of the hill."
Failing to find the florist, Kojiro glanced toward the temple compound across the way, where a group of people was gathering around a corpse covered with reed matting. He went over to have a look. They were discussing plans for burial with the local priest. The victim had no identifying possessions on him. No one knew who he was, only that he was young and of the samurai class. The blood around the deep gash extending from the tip of one shoulder to his waist was dried and black.
"I've seen him before, about 4 days ago in the evening," said the florist, who went on talking excitedly until he felt a hand on his shoulder.
When he looked to see who it was, Kojiro said,
"I'm told Kakube's horse is kept at your place. Get him ready for me, please."
Bowing hastily, the florist asked perfunctorily,
"Are you going out?"
and hurried off. He patted the dappled gray steed on the neck as he led it out of his stable.
"Quite a good horse," Kojiro remarked. "Yes, indeed, a fine animal."
Once Kojiro was in the saddle, the florist beamed and said,
"It's a good match."
Taking some money from his purse, Kojiro threw it to the man.
"Use this for flowers and incense."
"Huh? Who for?"
"The dead man over there."
Beyond the temple gate, Kojiro cleared his throat and spat, as if to eject the bitter taste left by the sight of the corpse. But he was pursued by the feeling that the youth he had cut down with a drying pole had thrown aside the reed matting and was following him.
"I did nothing he could hate me for," he told himself,
and felt better for the thought. As horse and rider moved along the Takanawa High Road under the boiling sun, townsmen and samurai alike stood aside to make way. Heads turned in admiration. Even on the streets of Edo, Kojiro cut an impressive figure, causing people to wonder who he was and where he came from. At the Hosokawa residence, he turned the horse over to a servant and entered the house. Kakube rushed to meet him.
"My thanks for coming. It's just the right time, too," he said, as though Kojiro were doing him a great personal favor. "Rest a while. I'll tell his lordship you're here."
Before doing so, he made sure the guest was provided with cool water, barley tea, and a tobacco tray. When a retainer came to show him to the archery range, Kojiro handed over his beloved drying pole and followed along wearing only his short sword. Lord Tadatoshi had resolved to shoot 100 arrows a day during the summer months. A number of close retainers were always there, watching each shot with bated breath and making themselves useful retrieving arrows.
"Give me a towel,"
his lordship commanded, standing his bow beside him. Kneeling, Kakube asked,
"May I trouble you, sir?"
"What is it?"
"Sasaki Kojiro is here. I would appreciate your seeing him."
Sasaki. Oh, yes.
He fitted an arrow to the bowstring, took an open stance, and raised his shooting arm above his eyebrows. Neither he nor any of the others so much as glanced in Kojiro's direction until the 100 shots were finished. With a sigh, Tadatoshi said,
"Water! Bring me some water!"
An attendant brought some from the well and poured it into a